Welcome back to the second hour of Catholic Answers Live, Wednesday show. This hour, Trent Horn is with us, and we're going to talk a bit about apologetics and being a better apologist. Our number, if you'd like to speak with Trent, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Trent is an apologist at Catholic Answers, the author of many books, including his most recent book with Layla Miller. I'm not sure if he wrote it or if he just got his name on it, but hi, Trent. How are you?
Hello, Cy. Always good to speak with you.
And the book is called Made This Way.
That is right. And I did do a little bit of writing in that book, a good amount of co-authoring with Layla Miller, bringing my research on these important moral issues together with her experience as a mother of eight and as a prolific Catholic blogger. And I think people have really appreciated it.
I get the feeling people really have. I think you're being slightly modest there. It's been more than appreciated. I think a lot of people are grabbing up this book because this is a real difficulty that we parents have. I mean, the world seems morally beyond confused. It seems morally crazy. And you need to be equipped to help, you know, to talk to your kids about it. And people are looking for a lifeline. This book is it.
Right. And what we tried to do in the book is help bring together the teaching of the church to explain clearly for each of these moral issues, here's what the church believes, and here is the reasons why it's true, and then also how you explain it both to little kids in elementary school when the issues pop up unexpectedly, as well as to bigger kids in middle and high school who might challenge some of these teachings themselves.
888-318-7884 is the number. So how do I go about being a better apologist?
Well, you go about by being a better apologist by learning the faith as much as you can, and then just going out and defending it and learning lessons along the way as you defend the faith. I had a great interview on a podcast recently, classicaltheism.com, where we talked about how you can be a better case maker. How do you make the case for our faith? And what are, you know, pitfalls to avoid? What are some important things to think about when you're sharing the faith? This can include common misunderstandings of the faith or misinterpretations of it. For example, it's not a great idea to say, well, Protestants believe you're saved by faith, and Catholics believe you're saved by faith and works. The Council of Trent, the Catechism, does not use the phrase faith and works. It can lead to an oversimplification and a distortion of what we really do believe. So it's little things like that along the way that as you explain the faith and dialogue with others, you'll see what are helpful things to share and what are less helpful ways when it comes to sharing the faith or answering objections to it.
And if you have questions along that line, 888-318-7884, something I noticed, Trent, when you go around, you know, different parishes and things and speaking in different places around the country, and I noticed that there are more apologetics groups that have formed at parishes than I ever remember before, where people will say, yeah, we form this apologetics group, we study so that we're ready to answer questions about the faith, and then they have projects that they do, that kind of thing. Have you noticed that too?
I have. I've noticed people who have bought cases of Why We're Catholic and now cases of Made This Way, which you can get at madethiswaybook.com, for groups at their parish that meet to discuss apologetics and how to become better at defending the Catholic faith. One such group invited me to their parish at St. Vincent de Paul Parish in Fort Wayne, Indiana, just over the past weekend. So it's really an exciting time to see lay people take ownership of their faith and be willing to go out and evangelize. Another great group is St. Paul's Street Evangelization. You have groups of lay people. They get together and they go right out where the people are, set up their tracts and their books, and give those away and engage in really good conversations with people. And they learn the art of apologetics. And it really is an art. And hopefully people can call in if you have questions about how do I defend the faith? What does it mean to be an apologist? How do you get started? How do you grow in this area? I mean, there's so many different nuances and even different styles of apologetics as well. So it's a neat field to talk about and learn how to get better at.
888-318-7884, the number 888-31 Truth. Now, when we say apologetics, I think our audience knows what that term is. But what about the objection that you might hear that, well, we really should be about evangelizing?
Well, that is a very good question to ask. Why should we focus on apologetics or the defense of the faith when shouldn't our main focus be evangelism? And the two go hand in hand. They are not synonymous. So evangelism is the sharing of the good news of the gospel with a world that needs it. So evangelism is just sharing the good news about our redemption and eternal life that comes to us through Jesus Christ. That's the good news of the gospel, and we share that by evangelizing. Apologetics is a subset of theology dedicated to defending the faith and defending that good news. So they're not the same thing. You can do evangelization without apologetics, and by just sharing the good news, and all right, it moves someone's heart and they come back to the church. Or you sometimes might do apologetics without evangelization. You defend an article of the faith, maybe to a fellow believer who's having difficulty understanding something. You're not evangelizing them because they already believe, but you're helping them to better share the faith. So they're not the same, but they go together. Many times when we evangelize the world, share the good news about Jesus Christ, there's going to be objections to it. It's good news, but it's too good to be true,
yeah,
is what some people might say. So we got to give them reasons. Sometimes I think really, Cy, one of the biggest things that is holding back the sharing of the gospel in the modern world today is this. There is a loss of a sense of sin. There is no understanding of the bad news. And this is something that many people will chide us for when we talk about moral issues, like in my book, Made This Way. People will say, well, you're being judgmental. And, oh, if you go out and evangelize, don't be judgmental. You know, you don't want to be off-putting to people. You don't want to be judgy or use harsh language. And you shouldn't use unnecessarily offensive language. But at the same time, if you do everything in your power to make sure someone always feels good when you share the good news with them, they may not accept it. Because if there's no bad news, why bother accepting the good news? Who cares? That's the biggest challenge we face today. At least in the ancient world, pagans had a sense of guilt over their sins. They didn't know what to do about it. And the gospel was a relief to them. Now people think the good news, the gospel, is the bad news because it's judgy and I don't like it. It imposes on my morality. That's one of the biggest problems that we're facing today, biggest hurdles when it comes to sharing the faith.
That makes sense. I wonder how we lost that. I mean, I suppose you could do a whole, I'm sure many people have kind of historical look at how the sense of sin was lost, the sense of God's mercy for the sinner, how that became a meaningless message because we don't believe we've done. I mean, you know, we're basically, well, I'll put it to you this way, and I'll let you be the apologist. What the person who says, look, Trent, you know, you talk about sin, but really it's just that, you know, people lack a good education or they have, you know, they didn't get the right upbringing. And the fact is we're just biological creatures. We're not, you know, all this sin stuff. It's just, you know, some people are well formed and have had all the advantages and some people are not.
Right. And I think what this does is that it reduces our responsibility as moral beings and moral agents, saying, well, you're not really responsible for your actions. You're just a product of causes around you. But then I might ask the question, look, if a lightning bolt sets a house on fire, you're not going to track down those electrons and put them in jail. You know, if a shark eats somebody, you're not going to put the shark on trial. I mean, you might hunt the shark, you might kill
it. Might need a bigger boat.
Yeah, right. But you're not going to say, well, you know, we need to capture him alive and then put him on trial and get it, you know, and see if he's guilty. No, we understand lightning bolts, sharks, tigers, these other elements that cause harm. We don't hold them morally responsible because they're the product of just physical causes in the world. They don't choose to do anything. They're forced to move by other things around them. But human beings are different. When a human being pins down a woman who is screaming and rapes her and refuses to take no for an answer, we don't say, oh, well, that's just copulation. You know, you see something like that at the zoo all the time. No, we say that's a moral crime, and that person has to be held morally responsible for this gravely evil act that they've performed. If you don't believe that, then you either have to hold non-human animals and natural disasters to the level of human beings, which would be a bizarro world, or you have to say human beings don't really have any moral responsibility at all. And deep down, people do have that. You know, people might say, well, you're just a product of this or that. But those excuses don't work for people on their own because their conscience still speaks loudly to them. Some people have dulled their consciences. They stop listening. They muffle it over time. But still for many people, their conscience will speak to them that they did something wrong, even if no one finds out about it. and they were meant for more than this. This is not the person they're supposed to be. Ironically, when people do wrong things, when they apologize to you, sometimes they'll use that phrase, "I'm really sorry, this is not who I am." As if,
oh, yeah, yeah.
As if, well, what do you mean this is not who you are? You just did this right now. Well, no, I have a true self, or a way that I'm supposed to be, a higher thing that one is aiming at. And if there's a goal we're aiming at, then sin makes a lot more sense, because all sin is, in Hebrew, it means to miss the mark. It means that we have not aimed for the righteous goal that God has led ahead for us.
We're talking about apologetics and being a better apologist, sharing your faith, explaining and defending the faith of the church. 888-3187-884 is the number. Already the line's starting to fill up. So if you've got a question for Trent, give a call. 888-3187-884. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with your calls for Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Every single day, I get to help our listeners of the Sunrise Morning Show wake up, find out what's going on in the church and the world, and then walk with them as we all seek to grow in knowledge and love of Jesus Christ and the Catholic faith. I mean, how could it get any better?
The Sunrise Morning Show with Anna Mitchell and Matt Swain. Tomorrow morning, 6 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, coming to you from two different locations today. Trent is in our studio in San Diego, California. I am here at the 19th Annual EWTN Catholic Radio Conference in Birmingham, Alabama, where radio folks from all around the country have gathered. EWTN, you know, is, Adam, you're probably aware of this, it's kind of a revolution in media. And you just meet the most fantastic people when you're around the EWTN folks. People who have started a radio station, people who have started whole radio networks, people who are trying to get something started. It's really something wonderful. And it's hundreds and hundreds of stations now. I got a mic here next to me. How many is it? How many EWTN stations are there? A million? Is there a million yet?
300.
Over 300. I know it's way over 300. You're just counting the English language ones, because they got Spanish language too. And that's all around the world too. So we're just delighted to be here at the conference, and we'll be here for the next couple of days, bring you some special guests over the next couple of days, one of whom will be Gloria Purvis. And, you know, Gloria is all right, but I have never met her in person. So I'm looking forward to doing a show with her in person. I think Greg and Lisa Popchak will be with us. Maybe we'll get Dr. Ray in here. We'll see who else we can get for you. And today we've got Trent Horn and a lot of people with calls for Trent. Trent, you ready to take calls?
Sure thing.
Lee in Sugar Land, Texas, which now I want to visit, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Channel 130. Lee, your question for Trent. Hi, Lee. I don't think we have Lee. Lee is off in Sugar Land. Well, we'll come back to Lee. Hang on, Lee. Sometimes people take a little break from their phone. Let's go to John in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on KBSF. John, your question for Trent Horn.
Hey, Trent, and hi. Thank you. I kind of have multiple questions here, but to start out, one, and it's funny this topic came up tonight because I had an incident today on social media where I learned I had a family member in California who's kind of become a disciple of a psychologist who's preaching the absurdities and the evils of religion. And I'm kind of getting the idea that she's following this a little bit. And and as I was reading this and stuff, things on her Facebook page, I instantly began to feel my blood begin to boil. So I've always been interested in apologetics and have continually read voraciously and I've learned most of my faith through my adult years, even though I went to Catholic school. But so one of my question is, how do you take the emotion out of it? Is there a systematic approach to not debating, but to in your apologetics, right. Is there a systematic approach in which you can keep your thinking straight, sure, when you're trying to explain something about the faith? And mm-hmm, and any tips you could give on that?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. First, just understand that the emotions that will come forward, a lot of times we can feel these emotions. I mean, even I get pretty emotional sometimes when I read things. I mean, right now, the things that make me the most emotional when I read them are things that are patently absurd, that cause grave harm to other people. So that's why sometimes even things related to abortion or transgender identity, things that I can't believe a rational person would accept, that also can cause extreme grave harm. It makes me upset and angry. And anger is not necessarily a bad emotion. A righteous anger motivates us to do good in a fallen world. The key is understanding is to think of our emotions and say, I control them. They don't control me. They're like the little pack of dogs I take on a walk, and I take them along the walk. They follow me. I don't let them drag me along, and I'm holding the leash. So the way to do that, I think, first is to be rooted in prayer. When we find ourselves in these situations, first and foremost, even if we feel that sense of pride, thinking I can do this on my own, to say, no, Lord, give me the words that you want me to speak. Lord, help me to understand this with your heart and mind, to truly reach the depths of this person's soul, to see not just their argument, but also where they're coming from and whatever emotional baggage they might be carrying. So So sometimes we also get angry when we read something and we think it's an argument, we don't know how to answer it. And so we get defensive. We get scared sometimes, thinking, oh my gosh, what if this refutes my faith? And I don't have the answer, and we're pressed on it, and that we can get defensive and flustered. And the anger, sometimes anger is usually a response to the feeling of injustice. That's its primary response. When we feel there's an injustice or we're wronged, we get angry. Sometimes anger, though, can be a defense mechanism when we're scared, when we think there's a threat, and it's our way to kind of fight back against that threat. So if we're angry because we think we can't answer a question, we should be humble and say, you know what? I don't have all the answers. There's people for 2,000 years who've been studying these things who know a lot more than I do. Maybe I should go and see what they say. I bet there's more to this than meets the eye. The book of Proverbs puts it well. Proverbs says that the first, I think it's like Proverbs 18, that the first who presents his case seems to be right, until another comes forward to challenge him. So your friend who rattles off all this stuff about why religion is bad, it can seem imposing at first, but say, all right, well, let's just take it one thing at a time. And John, when I examine arguments, when people present an argument to me, I use this analogy. I think of it as kind of like a table. Okay, so the table top, imagine the top of the table, that's the conclusion. That's what they're trying to prove. And if it's a real argument, it'll have legs to support it. If it's just an assertion, there's a difference between an argument and an assertion. An assertion is, religion makes people miserable in the long run. That's an assertion. How do you know that that's true? All right, well, we have this evidence here and that evidence here. Okay, now we've got an argument. Those are the legs supporting the table. Let me look at that. Are these good studies? What is it trying to prove? What do you mean by this? We can also say, does it follow? I could go a little bit more into this about analyzing the arguments, but let's just stop here. Is that a helpful guide for you about dealing with emotions? And then when the arguments come at you, see the conclusion and try to figure out what premises are holding it up and see if they make sense. So let me stop there. How is that for you?
No, that's a good start, especially, I like the way you were talking about the tabletop and the assertions and the legs and analyzing it that way. And I think that analysis also tempers a little bit of the emotion if you can get in the habit of doing that. I've got kind of a sarcastic streak sometimes and that I can't seem to sometimes control. And instead of just jumping at logical ways, just kind of want to twist the screws a little bit, just initially, and I have to learn to stop that. But yeah. No, I'm very interested in the way your approach to it. And the other thing would be too, do you have, like, for instance, in this particular case, sure, they're talking about religion as a form of abuse.
Yeah, well, let's play around with a sample case. What do they say?
There are studies that say that religion enables humanity to flourish. I mean, that's been the case through the generations, through history,
right. That
it's important for us. But where do you find things like that if you need it? I mean, just do you have is there a database for that? But
yeah, the question about religion's sociological effects on human beings is an interesting one. I don't think, though, that it is the primary source to determine whether or not a religious belief is true. You need to say what is the religious belief? What does it correspond to? Either there is a God, or either Jesus did rise from the dead, or he did not. And people will respond to religion in many different ways. The sociological study of religion is very difficult. You say, well, does religion make people better off, worse off? What does that mean? Because there are people who say that they're religious, for example. They'll say that they're a religious person, yet they rarely ever go to church. There are people who, you know, you meet these people all the time. They say they're Catholic. They show up at Mass on Christmas and Easter, but they don't give a second thought to the teachings of the church any other time of year. So that's why it gets difficult to study these things about religion. However, for the beneficial effects of religion, one good source, I believe Rodney Stark, is an author who has written a lot on this subject. He's cataloged a lot of the benefits of Christianity and Catholicism. I don't believe he's Catholic himself, but he's written a lot on this subject. So Rodney Stark might be a good area you could go to on that particular question. But aside from the data, I would say you don't even need a bunch of data to answer the question. I would just start with some basic what and why questions to get to the source here. So, and also what, why, and why does that matter? Sometimes people will bring up a point and it just has no relevance to the truth of our faith. What does it mean religion enables abuse? You're saying, well, abuse is something that we find in religious organizations because they have hierarchies and because it could be complicated. That allows abuse to happen. Okay, well why does that matter? I don't necessarily disagree with that, but if your answer is we should just get rid of religion, well, no, what you're really saying is get rid of hierarchical organizations. No more USA gymnastic teams, no more NFL, no more any other, you know, no more Boy Scouts, no more anything. That when you get human beings together, they will sin and hurt one another, whether they're religious or not. So when these things come up, John, you know, ask, what is this person saying? What is the evidence they're using to support this claim? And why does this claim matter in the first place? The claim may be just a non sequitur. It may not follow that even if the claim is true, it doesn't follow that religion is false or that it's something we should give up. So that might be another way I would look at it. Is that helpful?
Very much so. I really respect your work and I appreciate you taking the time to answer my questions.
Sure thing.
Thanks, John. Thanks very much. We're talking with one of our apologists, one of the finest apologists you'll meet anywhere, Trent Horn, about apologetics today. Your call is welcome, 888-318-7884. We go now to Adam in Cincinnati, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Adam, your question for Trent Horn.
Hi there, Trent and Cy. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Doing well.
You're welcome. I appreciate you taking my call. It was a friendly discussion, and all honesty, probably due to the fact of family matters and death itself. But the question was, he had put an article online about why are we able to put to death our pets but not our Aunt Sue or something like that. And I saw that he was being honest and truthful about it, and I was responding to him in charity, but I just wanted to hear what you would have to say if you were approached with that question. Why put to death Fido, but not Aunt Sue?
Right. Well, the simple reason is we can put Fido to death for almost any reason we feel like, because Fido does not have a right to life. Fido is not a human being who has intrinsic value, dignity, and human rights. Now, Fido is a living creature that can feel pain, and so dogs and cats and other living creatures as moral beings, as rational moral beings, we should not cause them unnecessary pain. So it would be morally wrong, for example, to set Fido on fire as a way, you know, take him to the vet and the vet just douses him in gasoline and puts him on fire to end his life. That causes him unnecessary suffering. Now, that doesn't mean we can't cause animals suffering. We cause them suffering by killing them so that we can eat them. But that doesn't harm them. So I guess what the person is saying is, look, if my dog is suffering horribly, we put that dog out of his misery. But we don't do that to my Aunt Sue. Why don't we do that? It's because we value your Aunt Sue more. You can say this. Doctors will do whatever it takes to kill Aunt Sue's pain, to treat the problem afflicting Aunt Sue. Even if it's very expensive, we will do that if it's beneficial to her as a patient. But Fido's just a dog. In fact, it would be irresponsible to spend a lot of money treating a dog or a cat when that money could go towards human beings. I might wrap this up in a bow when we come back from the break, but that is the issue here, that if beings are suffering, we'll ease their suffering, but we respect the rights that human beings have when they suffer.
Hang on, Adam. We'll do more when we come back. Trent Horn is our guest, and we're talking about apologetics with an apologist. We'll be right back with more of that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humana Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humana Vitae. We asked five distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humana Vitae from five perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic of contraception comes up among friends, family, and co-workers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
We live in an age of indifference. Does truth exist? Maybe. Is there a God? Who knows? Does it matter what religion you believe in? Probably not. If you think so, fine. I'm spiritual, but not religious. Apologist Matt Nelson says this indifference is the great spiritual sickness of our age, a product of the relativism that dominates our culture. And rather than remain indifferent, he did something about it. In his new book, Just Whatever, Matt looks at the different kinds of indifference you likely encounter in your friends and family members, and maybe in yourself, and offers an antidote to the problem that plagues our age. Order your copy of Just Whatever today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders. There are a lot of misconceptions about the Catholic faith. We clear them up on Call to Communion, tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking apologetics with an apologist. If you'd like to be a better apologist, that is our topic this hour, and you are welcome to talk with Trent Horn about that. When we went into the break, Trent, you were in the midst of talking with Adam in Cincinnati, who was looking for an answer for a friend who wants to know why we put down animals but not humans.
Right. And there's more we could nuance on this question. I'd like to go into it just a little bit more because it's a common term it's a common argument by euthanasia and assisted suicide advocates that's thrown out there, basically saying we're more compassionate to animals that suffer than humans who suffer, that we consider it inhumane to let a dog or a cat live when they're in chronic pain, and so we just simply euthanize them. We just inject them with a drug to kill them. And nobody bats an eye at that. We think that that's fine. Whereas with your Aunt Sue or your Grandpa Bill or even a younger person who has been in an accident, who is sick or in pain, we won't euthanize them. But what they fail to recognize here is that the reason we euthanize most animals in this country is not because they're in chronic pain, but it's because they're unwanted. We euthanize them because that animal's life is more of a burden to us than we want to take on. So usually, even if they are sick or, you know, they're in pain, we could maybe spend $50,000 to $100,000 on a surgery to ease their pain. We could use intravenous drugs to ease their pain, but we wouldn't do all that. We'd say that's a waste of money. It's just a dog or a cat. You just kill them. But not even if they're in pain. Sometimes it's just there's an overpopulated area and there's too many dogs and cats. And no one's going to take care of them, and you don't want them roaming the streets becoming feral and stray. So they're just euthanized because they're unwanted, and there's no one who's going to care for them. Should we do that to elderly shut-ins? They're unwanted. No one wants to care for them, and it would be expensive, you know, tens if not hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to care for them. No, we don't. We treat humans as having more value than animals. Now, that doesn't mean that a human being who is near the end of their life, like if you have an animal near the end of their life, you might, you know, euthanize them. It doesn't mean, however, with a human being near the end of their life, you use every treatment available to extend their life. Some treatments are disproportionate. They're burdensome financially or physically or emotionally. And they have very little benefit or no benefit to the patient. So you're not obligated to use these disproportionate means of care or what used to be called extraordinary means of care. You are obligated to provide human beings, in virtue of their humanity, ordinary means of care that provide a benefit to the patient. So, and there's more we can talk about that. We have a 20 answers booklet on end of life issues that some of our listeners may be interested in that goes into the topic in more detail.
Okay, Adam.
That sounds great. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Sure thing.
Appreciate that call. Let's go to Jordan in New Orleans, listening on 690 AM. Jordan, your question for Trent Horn.
Hi, Trent. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a Protestant friend who is currently in his first year of seminary, and we have some pretty healthy banter back and forth.
Sure.
But we continue to get onto the topic of predestination and salvation.
Right.
We're actually both reading the Confessions of St. Augustine, I think for probably pretty different reasons.
Right. Sure.
But he, there was an excerpt from the text that where Augustine talks about how God is immutable and how God immutably knows and wills. And he asked me how that aligns with my view of how people are saved.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to give him the best explanation that I could, you know, that through baptism we're saved, we're being saved, and we have hope for salvation.
Right.
But he said that he would take that explanation to imply that God is mutable or changeable, and I didn't understand where he got that from. And he made a pretty bold claim that most Catholics, or all Catholics and most Protestants, believe that man is the ultimate cause of salvation. So I guess my question is, how can I argue
sure.
my faith in the Catholic teaching on this?
Right.
In a respectable way.
So now, he said most Christians, including most Protestants, believe man is the ultimate cause of his salvation, but he does not believe that.
He believes it's God, right?
Right. And he says even many Protestants believe that. Is he, I right. wonder what seminary he's going to, is he Reformed or Calvinist by any chance?
You know, I really don't know.
Hmm. Might be worth asking, because it sounds like that with the language that he's using. So among Protestants, well, basically among Reformed Protestants or Calvinists, there is the belief in what's called monergism. That's the idea that salvation occurs 100% through God's actions. So God determines who will be saved. And even though they don't like to really admit it, God determines who will be damned. And then God saves people. He chooses who will be saved. Then he saves them, gives them grace that is irresistible. And then those people will unfailingly go to heaven. And in fact, Jesus died on the cross only for those people. He did not die for the people who are going to hell. He only died for these people that God chose. So that might be the view. It sounds like if he believes that God is the one who saves us, he might fall into that view of thinking, that theology. First, what you can share with him is that the Catholic Church does believe in predestination, that God is sovereign, nothing surprises God, he has a plan for the universe, and he did choose us, that he chose to give us his grace, chose us for salvation. We are the elect, the ones who are chosen. The paragraph you can point him to in the Catechism is paragraph 600. It says, "To God, all moments of time are present in their immediacy. When, therefore, he establishes his eternal plan of predestination, he includes in it each person's free response to his grace." So what he said is like, well, if God, you know, if we can decide whether we're saved or not, it's kind of how he's looking at it. If we decide and we're in time and we respond to God, isn't that going to change God somehow? No, not at all. Because what the Catechism is saying here in paragraph 600 is that God is outside of time. God sees past, present, and future in one moment. God creates the world. He sees all of it in one moment. Nothing surprises him. So when God creates the world, he has a plan for how everything is going to turn out. He's going to work everything to his good. But here's the thing with God. He's all powerful and all knowing. Because of that, he factors in our free choices within his plan. That includes our free choice to accept his grace or reject it. You can also say to him that the church believes, we agree with him, that we condemn a heresy called Pelagianism. That is the idea you can achieve heaven, you can stay in a state of grace without God's grace. The church condemns that. The Council of Orange in the early church also condemned semi-Pelagianism. That's the idea that you, on your own abilities, could go to God and say, God, I want you to save me. We can't do that. But what we can do is God can come to us and give us his grace, his offer of salvation, to move our heart in that direction, and then we can freely say, yes, I want it, or no, I don't. Or we could say, yes, I want your grace, Lord, and then later on down the line say, never mind, I don't want it, and commit a mortal sin and throw it away, but then respond to God's grace again and say, never mind, I am sorry, I am contrite for my sin, I would like to be restored to friendship with you. So what you can say to him, and going back to paragraph 600, is, look, we as Catholics, we believe God predestines, God saves us. We cannot save ourselves, but we are free to accept or reject his offer of salvation. So that might be where you could point him to. And then a few resources that might be helpful. My book, The Case for Catholicism, has a whole section on how we're saved. You may find that helpful. You might also like my debate that I had with James White on the question, can a Christian lose his salvation? You can find that on YouTube. So is that a helpful explanation, or would you like any follow-up on any of that?
No, that's very helpful. Thank you. I'll definitely be looking into those resources. I appreciate that.
No problem. Also, Cy, I'd like to add on to that, that obviously the issue of predestination is a thorny one. The church does not have a settled teaching about how exactly God's predestination works. I thought about actually making a little graphic about this to help explain it to people. That basically, if you imagine predestination on a spectrum, there are two views that we as Catholics are not allowed to believe in. We need to believe in predestination of some kind, because the Bible says we're predestined. Christians need to believe in that. But what that means, different people have explained it in different ways. So on the one hand, like I just mentioned, the Calvinist view that God determines and wills everything and that man's free choices have no effect in the matter whatsoever, we're not permitted to believe that. Man does have the ability to accept the grace of God or to reject it at a later time. So that's not a permitted view of predestination in the sense that God actively willed every single thing that happens, including our own sins or rejection of him. On the other extreme, though, are people who say that human beings basically choose things. You can't believe in Pelagianism, I mentioned earlier, but also the idea that God doesn't predestine anything and that he doesn't even know the future. He doesn't know what's going to happen in the future at all. He's just really well prepared for it. That is a theology called open theism. That would be like the direct opposite of Calvinism. God doesn't determine anything. The future is indeterminate. No, the church is defined that God is all-knowing, and so he knows the future is something that can be known. He knows what will happen to us. There are prophecies he can make sure takes place. In between those two, the church has different views on predestination. There is the view of St. Thomas Aquinas called Thomism. There's also another view put forward by the Jesuit theologian Luis Molina called Molinism. And these are kind of more in-house debates among Catholics. So the bottom line, go back to paragraph 600. It just says, we believe God is outside of time, so he has a plan of predestination. That includes within that plan our free response to his grace.
Okay. Yeah, that's very, very clear. Trent Horn is our guest this hour. Our number, 888-31-TRUTH. And if you have a question about apologetics, if you have, maybe you've been thinking, I'd like to be better at this, this is the perfect time to call and talk with Trent. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of your calls after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Have a question? We've got answers.
Catholic Answers.
I love it.
Live.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Listeners to Catholic Radio, I think, benefit most, at least initially, from what I call remedial catechesis. What Catholic Radio does is it becomes an echo chamber for the teaching authority of the Catholic Church. And what we're doing is teaching many things which have been neglected over the last 40, 50 years. If you listen to Catholic Radio, you know what the Catholic Church teaches.
Al Cresta thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are on our annual pilgrimage to where it all started, the home of the worldwide home, really, of a great percentage of Catholic broadcasting, whether it's radio broadcasting or television broadcasting, is here in Birmingham, Alabama. You probably know that that's Rita Rizzo's fault, also known as Mother Angelica. And it's just a great pleasure to be here at the radio conference in Birmingham. And I mentioned that it's a pilgrimage for us, Trent, but you have another pilgrimage. You do a pilgrimage every year, right?
Well, I did one last year to the Holy Land, and I'll be doing another one this year to Greece in the footsteps of St. Paul. We'll visit the sites where St. Paul sent letters to different Christian communities, and we'll also be visiting Ephesus in Turkey and the island of Patmos, where St. John was exiled and wrote the Book of Revelation. Very excited about it. We still have some spots left, and you can learn more about that at the website for the pilgrimage, which is Greece2019.com.
I still can't believe you got the website Greece 2019. Like, how did Greece not get the website Greece 2019? It just...
They weren't thinking ahead. I guess... I guess if they were, like, doing the Olympics in 2019, which would be an off year, you wouldn't do that. Yeah. If there was a big event, otherwise, nobody thinks of it. So I'm also making sure to get Cy Kell at 2019 as well, because who knows what could happen.
That's true. That's why I'm running for something. No, you can't run in the odd number years.
In 2019, I don't know if any offices are open. You could start your campaign really, really early.
We had a big election. Did you know that yesterday, Trent? We had a big election. I got to go read about it because
we did. I was really, really bummed because I didn't win anything.
No, I was so happy because the most important proposition in the country passed yesterday.
What is that?
We're getting rid of standard time in California. We're just going to stay on daylight savings.
Well, I thought that was contingent on Congress acting.
Contingent. Yeah. I'm going to go look up contingent. You take the next call. Okay. Molly in Portland, Oregon, listening on Mater Dei Radio. You are up next. Molly, your question for Trent Horn. Hi, Molly. I love the name Molly, by the way. Even if she's not there, I still love the name Molly. Hello, Molly. Are you there now? That's all right. Still love the name Molly.
Good golly, Miss Molly. Where could she be?
Oh, okay. Oh, that is Trent.
Sorry, I had to.
Is your last name Corn or Horn? Because that was...
It's pronounced
Corny.
Cornet.
All right. Let's try Michael in Lafayette, Indiana, and then we'll come back and see if Molly's still around. Michael in Lafayette, Indiana, do you have a question for Trent?
Hello. My question is, do you have any advice for people who defend the faith without getting defensive?
Sure. Don't be out to win the fight. Be out to... understand the other person. A lot of times I think we get defensive when we are trying to defend our faith because we imagine our conversation. Usually we're most defensive, I think, when we're engaging people online, when we're using Facebook comm boxes, for example, comments, Twitter back and forth. And here it's easy to be defensive and angry because you're kind of, it feels like you're arguing with a robot. And who knows, it could be a robot. It could be some kind of bot out to get you. So it's easier to say something to text on a screen than it would be to a person right in front of me. And when that happens, I think you should say to yourself, you know what? I don't have to engage this person online in a lengthy argument. My time is very valuable. I only have so much of it, and I should use it to build up God's kingdom and not lose my peace over something like this. So one, I think it's important that you can tell people, usually sometimes this happens in person, but also, I mean, it happens mostly online, to let people know, hey, I'm willing to answer questions, but I don't feel like getting into a big debate right now. And I think that when you're engaging people and you're feeling getting defensive, lower the bar a little bit. Your job is not to beat the argument, refute the person, get the last word in. You don't need to do that. You can always say in a conversation, especially online, hey, it was great chatting with you. I liked sharing some of this. I think I've shared enough to make my position known. And if you want to learn more, you could go here. But I hope you have a really blessed day and, you know, God bless. And the person will come back on and say, you bailed on the argument. You bailed on what we're talking about. And you're like, well, look, you don't have a right to my attention. I shared with you and I hope it benefits you and other people that read this. So I think that what you can do is say, okay, I'm not here to win the argument, refute the person. This is not a boxing match. Instead, I'm going to ask this person questions. When you're feeling defensive, just ask the person questions, whether they're in person or online. What do you believe about this? Why do you think that? How do you know that's true? What do you think about this response to your argument? And just realize you don't have to be the boxer. You can be the reporter. You're out just to get the scoop. Find out what this person believes. And then you can tell them, hey, you know what? I'd like to give you some more on this for you to think about. Do you mind if I just go look up a few things so I can make sure to get you a really good answer? And then when you take it slowly in that way, you don't have to be defensive about it because you're not in a fight. You're not in a boxing match. You're not in a debate. You're in a conversation. You're both trying to figure out the truth, and the person should just be respectful of you in that regard. And you can show them respect by just asking them a lot of questions like, what do they think and why do they think that? Because at the very least, they will feel heard. And a lot of times, many people, they just want to let their views be known and understood, and you can help them. And when you do that, you'll diffuse the hostility a little bit. Is that helpful?
That's very helpful, and I think that advice is good for myself as well as the other person, because it sounds like charity on like all sides here.
That's right. And remember also, it's kind of funny, Michael, we had a previous caller who said, I want to turn the screw a little bit, but I want to be nice. How do I do that? Well, in his letter to the Romans, St. Paul quoted the Proverbs when they said, when you perform an act of kindness for an enemy, it's like heaping hot coals on their head. So if you're really kind and charitable to someone who's mean to you or attacking you, and you don't have sarcasm buried within it, you're just trying to respond politely and courteously, that can make them really upset. And it indirectly accomplishes your goal of turning the knife a bit. But it's not bad because that's not what you are directly intending. This fall, Catholics, we call this the principle of double effect. You don't intend to want to really make the person upset. You intend to treat them in a courteous and fair manner. And if they get upset, well, that's on them for doing so. But when you're in these situations, I mentioned this to the other callers, always make sure you're led by the Spirit. Pray, avail yourself of sacraments, seek counsel from others. That will give you those supernatural graces to allow you to have calm composure with those that you're speaking with. Also, what can be helpful, you know, this thought just popped into my mind. God likes to do this. What he does is he rattles around in your mind and he pulls out something people need to hear. I think sometimes we get angry and defensive with other people about the faith in our conversations because we are off kilter or off balance. You know, I think about the times in my life when I'm rude to people, even on Catholic Answers Live, when I have had a bad day and I haven't handled a conversation as well as I could have. And a lot of times that happens when I didn't get sleep the night before. I had a fight with my spouse or with my children. I'm stressed. I haven't been to Mass. I haven't prayed. I've let stress and worry and anger get inside of me. And then when I'm in these conversations, it comes out in all the negative ways. So I think one way to not be defensive in conversations is to take care of yourself spiritually, emotionally, physically. Make sure you're getting rest, eating right, exercising. When you have balance in life, you're much better to engaging other people on these conversations. You feel this peace inside of you, and you have that perfect peace of Christ both in the spirit and the body. Well, you can have just, you know, really good and easy conversations. At least that's what I think.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate that. Appreciate that call. Trent, don't argue with Laura.
I know. You never win. that is the number one rule you have to learn that I've learned in all of these years. I am just not right, and I have to just accept that.
That is not the lesson you should be taking. She is so much nicer a person than you are.
No, I know she's nice. When we have our fights, I'm the one who has instigated things and sent the train off the rails.
Can you imagine fighting with Trent Horn? Man, I just thought about that. That's a horrible thought.
Do you know what is terrible about the disagreements that we have? When we have disagreements, I frequently resort to the Socratic method. And my wife has forbidden that at home because it seems like I'm using some kind of a tactic, like a Jedi mind trick. Even though in most marriage advice books, they'll say the Socratic method is a helpful way to resolve conflict. We're just not allowed to do that at our house.
Trent, you need to learn the basic lesson. Do what your wife tells you. You're just missing it.
It is a simple lesson, but not an easy one. One I am trying to grow in
young
every
Padawan.
Day. Yes, indeed.
Rachel in Lafayette, Louisiana is up next. Start listening on Christ the King Radio. Rachel, your question for Trent.
Sure.
Hi, Trent Horn.
Hi.
I just want to say I think you're very patient with the people you debate, especially on you're only allowed to call in if you're against or for abortion and stuff. I think that's why I can listen to you for so long, because you're so patient. But
Thank you.
I don't know what your wife would say. But my question was, I have trouble when I'm trying to talk about homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And it's it's not as obvious of a, like with abortion, you can give them a one-liner, like you're killing an innocent human. But with homosexuality, especially some of my family members are homosexual, and I mean, I love them very much, and they're sweet, they're good people, but they'll oversimplify it by saying, how does that directly affect you, or how does it directly affect the world? You know, if he wants to do this in behind closed doors, why do you care?
Yeah.
And it's almost like they have to be religious for me to agree on a certain ground, like, well, you have a soul. But of course, not everyone believes that. So where do you start?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I think you could try to find common ground with them and say, well, normally I agree with you. If someone is doing something in private that doesn't affect me, it probably isn't my business. But let me ask you a question. If someone does something behind closed doors that hurts themselves, that causes themselves grave harm, if I care about that person, shouldn't I tell them what they're doing is causing themselves grave harm? Like if, let's say they're addicted to drugs or pornography or gambling, and so they do something that causes themselves harm. Now, they may jump and say, well, homosexuality doesn't cause harm. You can say, well, let's just back it up a little bit. Would you agree just doing something in general that's bad for you, that is not in the way you should be living, that could harm you, even if it's done in private, I can care about that, and I want to reach out to those people. The next step would be then saying, okay, well, does homosexual or same-sex behavior, is that harmful? Is that something that we should be doing? And I think many people will say, well, yeah, what's the harm or what's the problem? And the reason people think that, Rachel, I believe, is because they use terms like homosexual and heterosexual. And they focus more on, when they use a term like homosexual, the first thing they think of is a person who is like them in basically every respect, except the other person that they love is just a little bit different than the person that we love. You know, I love my wife and my wife happens to be a woman, and this person who identifies as homosexual, they love a man, if they're a man. Or if they're a woman, they love another woman, and maybe they are kind of more like me. And that's just all people look at it as. But we have to look and say, what about the sexual act itself? So I would recommend asking them the question, what is sex for, and can we ever misuse sex? Do you think sex for polygamy or even sex with animals or cousins or siblings, would that be wrong? So I would get to the question, what is sex for, and can we misuse sex to harm ourselves? Why don't you stay on the line, Rachel, since we're at the end of our show together. I'd like to get your email address, and I'll send you some more resources on this topic.
Thanks, Rachel. Hold on. Trent Horn, thanks very much for another fine hour.
Thank you very much, Si.
And if people want to go on pilgrimage with Trent, Greece 2019 is the website. And we'll see you tomorrow from the 19th annual EWTN Catholic Radio Conference on Catholic Answers Live.